The truth is, we're really responsive to positive reinforcement.
Is the goal that they would not be using anymore?
The goal is well-being, right?
So even if that includes them continuing to use... When I was 12 years old, I started smoking pot. By the time I was 15 years old, I was shooting methamphetamine. At that moment, I would have been all for programs that would have let me continue in my addiction, that would have made it at least safe to do that.
Welcome to today's episode of Falling to Freedom, where addiction ends and faith begins, the weekly podcast that brings thoughtful, informed, and challenging discussions about addiction to the forefront of everyone's minds. We join our host now, Chad Lacombe, for today's topic.
All right. Well, today we're joined by Dr. Ricky Bluthenthal, and he is professor of population and public health sciences at the Keck School of Medicine at USC. And we're really grateful that you came to meet with us today and have a discussion. I think, and if at any point I'm mischaracterizing, you know, your views or points, then please just correct me. But we're here to have, you know, a good faith and hopefully informational discussion on not only substance abuse and its prevalence, but the approaches to dealing with it. And so at least right now, it seems like there's two kind of tracks. And it's often, it seems to me like it's framed as an either or proposition, but I don't know that that is necessarily the case. And, you know, I just from the gate will just admit that, you know, I'm not an expert on these things. I just, you know, I have my own lived experience in this and my own observation and then your expertise. So I'm hoping that it will just, you know, bring out some truths on these two tracks. And those are the permissive harm reduction policies that are pretty much California's stance right now, and abstinence or treatment options. And so I just kind of start by just turning it over to you and let kind of open it up.
Yeah, happy to do so. So let me just start with a couple of, they're not corrections. They're just a different, probably, worldview.
Okay.
So, you know, I wouldn't think about, I don't think about harm reduction as permissive or not permissive. Mm-hmm. There is a philosophy behind it, and I'll explain that to you in a second, in the context around it. But most of the people who are in either substance use disorder treatment professionals or even folks like me who are researchers, mm-hmm. you know, really think about these strategies on the continuum. And mm-hmm. so you can have, you know, the harm reduction at one end, and let's just say, you know, we put everyone in jail anytime they used an illicit substance at the mm-hmm. other end, right? So they're on a continuum. And on the harm reduction continuum is certainly people, if they want to be abstinent, harm reductionists are happy to support that. Mm-hmm. So it's not a situation where the goal of harm reduction has anything necessarily to do with substance use disorders in terms of whether people are using or not using. It's supportive mm-hmm. of what people want to do. Mm-hmm. And the truth is harm reduction programs are really effective at getting people into treatment. And they have an empirical track record of doing that in a way that actually doesn't exist when you have like strict prohibition. Mm-hmm. So let me back up.
Okay.
So where does harm reduction come from? In the public health world, you know, we often think about problems operating on three levels, mm-hmm. right? So there's like primary prevention, which is, hey, we don't want you to start this thing. Or mm-hmm. what are the things that we do that help you avoid starting something? Mm-hmm. There's secondary prevention, which is, hey, you start it, but let's try and get you out of it as soon as possible because it's dangerous.
Sure.
And then there's tertiary, and that's where harm reduction comes in, where you have it. Let's use the case of opiate use disorder. You have chronic opiate use disorder. You're physically dependent. Now what? Mm-hmm. And so harm reduction emerged out of that space. Mm-hmm. And it emerged into a space where we weren't actually doing very much. So just as a background, you know, I've been doing harm reduction research since 1991. Mm-hmm. And my path there began with the HIV epidemic,
okay.
which back in the late 80s and 90s was a terminal illness. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, when people who inject drugs, people at that time who were using heroin, were at elevated risk for getting HIV. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have an option. So unfortunately, and this has gotten a little bit better over time, But back then, you know, methadone was probably the most heavily regulated substance in the United States. Mm. So it was very difficult to get a methadone, which is probably the gold standard mm-hmm. for treating people with opiate use disorder. Mm-hmm. And buprenorphine wasn't even widely available at the time. Although in Europe, it had been around for decades, but mm-hmm. that's another story.
Yeah.
And so you have this, you know, contagious, you know, infectious disease that kills people. What are you going to do about it? Mm-hmm. There's not enough methadone facilities to provide for the demand. And in a place like Oakland, where I was working at the time, which isn't all that big, there still wasn't enough. Right. And it was hard to get people in and hard for people to stay in. It wasn't paid for by insurance like it is now in, in most of California. So what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. Are you going to just let people continue to get HIV? Or are you going to respond with these sort of, you know, tertiary responses? And so that's where harm reduction comes from. It's, hey, you're getting HIV in part because you share syringes. There's no human meaning in sharing syringes. So people don't do it because they're trying to feel close to each other. You know, it's just, we don't have enough. And so people began giving out syringes and taking in the dirty ones. Or the used ones. And, you know, what we found is it's highly effective. So if you look at the research...
When you say highly effective, what do you mean?
It's highly effective at preventing HIV.
Okay.
And so if you look at areas that had syringe service programs, as we now call them, and places that didn't, you know, the prevalence would be twice as high in places that didn't have syringe service programs. And if you look at people who use the programs and don't, the risk behaviors are much higher among people who don't use the programs and those that do. So that's great evidence of the one of the first principles, I think, of harm reduction, which is if you want someone to have a different behavior, you should give them a resource to support that different behavior. And that's what harm reduction does. You apply it in the case of HIV and syringes. It's been used to great effect around overdose deaths by giving people naloxone, which is a medication that reduces overdoses and has a, you know, real life and real time impact on human mortality. And so that's a first one. So let's give people things that are practical that they can use.
I have a question. How does facilitating their use, even if it is, you know, in a sense, healthier in the sense that, you know, now there's no, you know, less chance of transmittable diseases. But how does that, you know, incentivize people to not continue down that path?
Well, the goal is to keep them alive. You can't recover if you're dead.
Right.
And so, and that's why I laid out that format. So there's different things you would want to do for primary prevention or even secondary prevention. When you're at the tertiary prevention point, you have limited tools, right? So all the other things that we've done, the stigma against drug use that then becomes the stigma on drug users, prohibition, all of those things have already not worked. That's just the circumstance. They have not worked. And so you have a choice. Do you want to let HIV spread and get into broader and larger populations? Or do you want to, in a very practical way, engage people and get them a tool that they need that will prevent them from getting HIV? But there's more going on than just that. And this is also important to remember. So we have this whole infrastructure in our society that says, okay, we don't want you to do that thing. And so we're going to put in place all kinds of disincentives. Negative reinforcers. And those things haven't worked for you, right? At this point, those things haven't stopped you from using heroin. They haven't stopped you from potentially saving syringes. And so, you know, you sort of have this question, what are you going to do about it? And I think part of the claim of harm reduction and the principle is, okay, all of those negative things didn't work. But what do we know about human psychology? The truth is we're really responsive to positive reinforcement. So if I begin to engage with you when everyone else has shook you to the side, you see me as a potential lifeline. I'm giving you things that you need, and then I can give you other things that you might need. Right? And so there's, you know, many studies showing we, you know, these programs have been used to help people get TB screened and treated, get hepatitis B vaccinations. Nowadays, they're used a lot for hepatitis C. Actually helping people get into screened and then get into treatment. So now we have a connection and we can begin building on that. And we're doing that because we're being non-judgmental. We're being non non-punitive, and client-directed, right? Mm-hmm. So we're working with the strengths that you might have in any given moment and giving you additional resources so you can develop more strengths. Mm-hmm. And the truth of the matter is, you know, when we look at long time, again, these are studies, one published in 1994 in San Francisco. If you look at people's engagement over time, people stay engaged. And in fact, their drug use begins to go down. So that's the first thing. And then the second piece is these places are great conduits into treatment. So nowadays, now that we have buprenorphine, which is easily prescribed, most strength programs can get you, you know, you'll show up, you say, hey, I'm interested in buprenorphine. They'll get you on a telehealth call with a physician. Mm-hmm. The physician will prescribe buprenorphine, and then they'll walk you to the pharmacy and pick it up. Mm-hmm. And then you're off and running. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think and that's why when we first talked, I said, you know, these are complex issues.
Sure.
And we're never going to have simple solutions. So let me say something that you don't expect me to say.
Okay.
Which is, look, there's all kinds of ways to get to recovery. Mm-hmm. You know, and for some people, it's a therapeutic community. For some people, it's NA or AA or CA, right? For some people, it's a work camp. Mm-hmm. Right. I don't think many people, but for some that works for them. And so, you know, I'm open to anything that works for people.
Yeah.
And I think that and that's why I made this point that I think it's easy to fall into because we're in a very polarized moment in the country. Yeah, it's absolutely. So easy to fall into the, well, I have this belief and but look, I have my own beliefs too.
Sure.
My beliefs aren't facts. Mm-hmm. And when you look at what's actually happening in the world, what I see is, hey, let's use everything. Because when you meet someone and they're having a substance use situation, right, mm-hmm. whether it's problematic or not, they're going to need different things, mm-hmm. right? So would I say, hey, we need to have syringe service at the high school? No, because we don't need it at the high school, mm-hmm. right? That's not who it's getting. That's who it's directed at. You know, what I would say is that when we think about these principles, though, I feel very strongly in general as mm-hmm. a human and a social scientist that, hey, if I can reward you for something, mm-hmm. you're going to be more likely to do it than if I punish you for it.
Yeah. Punishment does have its place, though, but I would just kind of push back against, you know, because I've, you know, just been doing my research since we decided to do this, and I understand, you know, there's a wide range of probably where you fall on the scale with these things as far as harm reduction. Mm-hmm. I would push back against the premise that, you know, the other side of it is only punitive, right? And that's the way it seems to be framed a lot of times. Mm-hmm. It's like either try and help them in what's framed as a compassionate and respectful and human rights-centered way, mm-hmm. or throw them in jail for drug use. But I don't think that's accurate. I mean, that has happened, sure. That has happened. But I don't think when I'm saying, you know, I think people should do everything they can to get away from drug use, and I don't think it's just like, well, that person has a right to, you know, to do that on their own. I don't think the only other option is, you know, criminal charges for drug use. I mean, you can have programs, you know, you could like diversion programs and things like that, where instead of, if there's an actual, you know, problem, send them to some kind of treatment instead of, you know, whatever the consequences might be. So there's, you know, middle ground there that isn't just punitive, which seems to be the way it's usually framed, is it's either this or it's throw all drug users in jail. And I don't think that's accurate. Well,
I mean, I think that unfortunately that reflects the reality of the country, right? So I don't know how old you are. I'm 60.
Okay. I'm 52.
All right. So you missed some of the action.
Okay.
So, you know, I grew up, became an adult in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And we just decided we were going to deal with these problems by really putting a lot of people in jail. Mm-hmm. So I lived in Washington, D.C. from 1986 to 88. Washington, D.C. was putting 100,000 people in jail every year. Mm-hmm. That was their response to the crack use epidemic. So,
but what about today? I mean, maybe the 80s.
Well, I'll get to today because I think let me finish up.
Okay.
So we did have that for decades where we really were, hey, you're using a substance we don't like, we're putting you in jail, including cannabis, which is now legal in many states and for the majority of people in the United States. Okay, so what about now? You said the policy of California is harm reduction. I would say California is dabbling with harm reduction, but they're still arresting people for drug use in large numbers, you know, or associated charges, right? We still have a cultural infrastructure and a social service infrastructure that means that if you have a substance use on board, substance, illicit substance on board, or even a non-illicit substance, you know, you might get your kids taken away from you. Right? So that infrastructure never went away. And it's interesting that you brought that up because it sort of really dovetails with something that I've been thinking about a lot lately, which is when we try to do this alternative method of sort of giving people resources they need, being engaging with them, seeing their humanity, dignifying them, and then working with them to get to a better place. We're still doing that in a context where, whether I feel like drug use is stigmatizing or not, the society does, right? And so they have family members who don't talk to them anymore. And they have friends that have abandoned them. And children they can't see because they have this history, whether it be criminal or documented in the child protective service system. So we're still operating in an environment that is highly punitive towards drug use. And so, you know, that's the world as we find it. And, you know, there are a lot of situations in our society where, like, hey, we're just in this place, right? Like, driving in, this is a complete tangent, but let me just make this point. Like, I was driving out here from my neighborhood, which is sort of, you know, central northwest Los Angeles, right? So it's a two-hour trip. And you see, you know, and I grew up in, I lived in Diamond Bar when I was in high school. So about halfway there, so I'm familiar with the dynamics. Like, let's say we said, you know what? We really do need to get away from driving cars, right? And then I'm driving through these places, and see, like, there are houses everywhere, right? And they're not, you know, there are jobs here, but most of the jobs are somewhere else. That's the reality, right? So I can't say to you all, and I'm sensitive to this because I have an electric vehicle, which I did not drive here, right? Okay. Right? Like, you need infrastructure. Like, if I wanted to drive my electric vehicle here, I need infrastructure to be able to do that. And so this is another one of those situations where, like, the world is as it is. So it's a little bit less about, hey, is it punitive or not? It is punitive. That's not for you and I to decide. That's the experience of people who use drugs. Can we help them by giving them resources that they need? Can we help them by engaging with them respectfully? Can we help them by identifying their strengths and their intrinsic motivations to have a better life and a better well-being? 100%, and we should. Well, and let me just finish this thought. Let me contrast that with what happens when you put someone in the criminal legal system, right? Particularly if it happens when they're young, they're done. I mean, in some of my studies, and you know, I've done many studies, and I've seen tens of thousands of people who have substance use disorder. You know, if someone ends up in the criminal legal system at 12 or 13, particularly if they're a person of color and low income, they're done. They didn't get any education because you don't get it in juvenile, right? You don't develop the normal social skills the rest of us get by going to high school and suffering, right? You know, they're getting a different kind of training, right? You don't have networks that have people who are employed in it, right? You've been a drain on your family because they've worked to pay your legal expenses. You're not only harming the person by not treating them and then by, you know, really destroying their capacity to be an adult, but you're harming the whole community. And, you know, when you take into account how policing happens in this country, this is just the truth. You know, if you're an African-American person and you're smoking crack cocaine, your chances of getting arrested are way higher than if you're a white person. And that's a choice police make. And I wish that were not true, but that's the world we live in. And what I don't want to see happen is that we continue a approach that's expensive. Putting people in jail is very expensive. That doesn't stop the substance use. We know that because we have more substance use problems than ever, right? And that inhibits community's capacity to even create the conditions where someone might grow up and not feel like crack is a reasonable opportunity, a reasonable choice, or meth use is a reasonable choice, or prescription opiates are a reasonable choice. So that's what I'm sort of dealing with. So, you know, I do think there's a temptation to want to boil it down to, you know, it's this or that. And that's why I'm here, right? Yeah. Like, I don't talk to people.
And I don't believe that either. Right. I think that the solution is multifaceted. What would you say, in your opinion, both in general for harm reduction, you know, proponents, and then maybe even you personally, what's the ultimate goal for people, right? And I'm not just talking about, like, you broke it into like three categories, and you said this third one, tertiary, you know, is, you know, where it's specifically focused. But I'm just talking about people in general. Is the goal that they would not be using anymore?
The goal is well-being.
Right? So even if that includes them continuing to use...
Well, look, what's the substance that kills most of us in this country?
Well, it's fentanyl right now.
No, it's alcohol.
Well, fentanyl right now, according to NIH, is the leading cause of death between 18 and 44-year-olds. That's on any NIH's website, which I think you're a part of their
I've been funded by them. No, but the thing to realize is that alcohol use kills more people than illicit substances do.
It says the leading cause of death is
between ages blank and blank.
18 to 44.
Right. So I'm talking about...
even the older population.
Exactly. So when you take into account the whole, what's the source of mortality, it's alcohol use. And alcohol is legal. Mm-hmm. Right? So, you know, I think at the end of the day, and maybe this is the difference. And I'm gonna say this, and I think at the end it won't actually be a difference.
Okay.
Because I think the focus has to be on people and not on what they're putting in their bodies, right? And so I want them. Well, but there's lots of things that affect people and and everything around them. And so, you know, I think what I would say is, if well-being is your goal, you have to start with where are you at right now, and then do the things that make sense. So, like, and this is sort of the analogy maybe that'll get closest for you and I. So there's a lot of this talk about, oh, we should punish people, right? Spare the rod, spoil the child, right? There's a saying, spare the rod, spoil the child, right? So I'm a parent. I have two adult children. You know, you need to have consequences for your children, right? You need to create boundaries so that they can understand how to function in the world. And sometimes that includes a punishment. But that happens in the context, hopefully, and I think in my case, of a loving family. Yeah. So my children know they're the most important thing to me in the world and that I will do whatever I can to help them. And I've proven that time and time again, right? The problem when you take that kind of thinking and then you take it at the societal level is that we don't have a particularly caring society, unfortunately. You know, and it's particularly not friendly to low-income people. And so the punishment then arrives in that context in a way where, instead of saying, hey, you know what? And I'll use this as an example. So I was at a rally years ago. We have this thing called Measure J in LA County, which is really cool. So it's trying to set aside about 10% of the county budget to work for prevention, right? And so one of the people who was speaking in favor of this measure told this anecdote of the first time they had contact with the police. And that was, they were like 11. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. The police should have talked to this kid. So the question though becomes, what happens at that moment? So I can imagine a world where instead of the police saying, hey, we're going to take you to the jail and we're going to establish a record for you because you're outside at 3 o'clock in the morning, you shouldn't be. That will then, the next time you get stopped because you're standing in front of the 7-Eleven too long, we're going to really arrest you, right? Because we've got you in our system. And so we escalate. They say, well, why are you out here at 3 o'clock in the morning? Let's go to your home. Let's figure out what's happening there. Let's maybe bring in a social worker. There's obviously something chaotic going on. Let's give your family the resources they need so that you're not going to want to be outside at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're 11. That's way cheaper. And more likely to be effective. And that's sort of what Measure J is trying to do. So, I mean, I think the proposition I would make is that, yeah, are there some people who belong in jail? 100%. You know, there are people.
But I don't think that's the only other.
Hold on, let me finish. You know, if you're violent, sure. If you're breaking stuff up, you know, let's just get you to cool down. Let's get you out of the system. But I do think we need to be more creative about what are pathways for people to have better outcomes.
Yeah.
And so
I'd just like to remove, at least for our conversation, because the criminal element and punitive, you know, consequences, you know, forget that for a second. What about just advocating treatment and abstinence from those things? Because the reality is the results are not healthy of continued drug use, especially when someone is, you know, in it to the point that, you know, they're on the streets, they're not a part of, you know, just a normal part of society. I mean, probably better than 90% of long-term homelessness, there's addiction involved. It may not have been the root cause, but certainly once you're in that environment, it's a part of it. The numbers are there. Even crime, probably 80% of crime is may not be a drug-related charge, but drugs were involved and lowered a person's inhibitions or put them in a position where they would actually commit those things. And let me just share with you real quick, just to kind of maybe, you know, shatter your assumptions about me. So when I was 12 years old, I started smoking pot. Got my first Grand Theft Auto when I was 12 years old. Went to juvenile hall, got out, you know, pretty quickly after that. Stayed sober for a little while, quickly progressed to using methamphetamine. By the time I was 15 years old, I was shooting methamphetamine. So, and this was in the 80s. So there weren't a lot of 15-year-olds shooting drugs.
There you were not.
I was one of them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At 15, I got my second Grand Theft Auto. Instead of being sent to youth authority, they sent me to a treatment program called the Phoenix House. And I did good for a while, but eventually I left. Tried to make it, tried to go to high school, couldn't like cope in that kind of an environment, on and off drugs. Even went into the Navy to try and get away from the whole thing. Ended up getting kicked out of the Navy because of drug use. So it's like this continuing pattern. My life was just in shambles, no stability. By the time I was 21 years old, I was manufacturing methamphetamine. And I ended up shooting and killing somebody. And I went to prison for a long time for murder. I never would have committed that crime had I not been in that state of mind. Now, you know, at that moment in my life, I would have been all for programs that would have let me continue in my addiction, that would have made it at least safe to do that. I got hepatitis C from using needles. I don't have it anymore, thankfully. But I mean, I know what the consequences of that type of a lifestyle are on a person. And when I was in the middle of that, I would have been all for programs that would have enabled me to keep doing that, especially if it made my drug use free, if they're going to provide me the drugs. Now, in hindsight, you know, I've been out of prison since 2009. I own my own construction company. I'm a pastor in a church. I have a wife. I have a, you know, a life. I mean, I have ministry. I have a ministry to help people struggling with addictions find recovery. My life is like full now. I never even thought that could have been possible. And it never would have been if I would have continued in that addiction. It's only because I was able to get free from that addiction that any of this stuff was even possible. And so when I talk about like abstinence and I talk about treatment, I definitely don't think people should just be thrown in jail for drug use. I mean, I definitely don't think that. I spent 15 years in prison, starting on maximum security prisons. I know what that life is like, and I wouldn't wish that on anybody. But there's got to be options that are less than that, right? And I know just from my own experience that most of the people that I was in prison with, doesn't matter if they were white, black, Mexican. I mean, in prison, I was a minority. So, you know, it's like most people in prison, if they weren't using drugs or alcohol, wouldn't have been involved in the things they were involved in. I mean, it's just a reality. I mean, it is. And I know it because I was there. And so all of these other things go along with it. And so I'm not saying that harm reduction policies, especially, you know, trying to prevent somebody from getting AIDS or spreading AIDS or trying to prevent somebody from overdosing. Yeah, I mean, who'd be like, no, let them all die? Well, that is not my position. Good. You know, I'm very compassionate because I lived it. Yeah. But I think that anything that, you know, is going to encourage people to continue in it. I'm not saying that has to be just that, but where's the balance?
Let me go back to your story because I was very moved by it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't disagree with you that bad things happen as a consequence of substance use. Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with you about that. And a lot of people in jail will have had substance use disorder issues, mm-hmm. Or diagnoses before they get there. And sometimes they started before, you know, sometimes the issues were there before, sometimes they were after, right? Mm-hmm. What I want a society in is we ask the question when you're 12, mm-hmm. and stealing cars. Mm-hmm. Chad, what's up? what are you not getting? What can we give you that will make you not want to steal cars at 12?
It was a family. I mean, it wasn't that there was like abuse or anything, yeah. But I was looking for something, I think, that wasn't present. I mean, you can't force that into a family.
No, you can't. But we can create an opportunity structure, mm-hmm. where maybe you would, and again, I don't know the specifics, and you, and I don't want to get into them. But you know, you do want to try and create a situation where when you have that point of contact with someone who's 12, and we can take you off of that path at 12, yeah. in a way that we can't at 21.
Sure.
And you know, I think that's what the Measure J is, the possibility of asking, mm-hmm. ourselves that question, and then trying to create a care and infrastructure, whether it's midnight basketball or, mm-hmm. hey, let's get you into go-karting, you like cars, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. Let's be creative though,
yeah.
around engaging you and saying that there are choices here, yeah. And you know, ways in which even the cannabis use at 12, which again, cannabis is legal now. You know, cannabis use at 12 is not good for you, right?
No,
and it
leads to other things.
It can, and it also stunts your capacity to make different choices, right? Because, mm-hmm. you end up getting, you know, becoming emotionally stunted, or you can't if you're, mm-hmm. using it a lot, right? Mm-hmm. You just begin not dealing and learning, mm-hmm. and how to overcome frustration, and you know, all the stuff that we have to deal with in junior high school, sure. and high school. So, I mean, that's what I'm aiming for, mm-hmm. is a world where we're saying things are off track for you. And then the premise, what's the resource you need to get, mm-hmm. back on track? And you know, I think this applies to all of us. You know, one of the things, I'll just talk about myself. You know, when I was a kid, you know, I had behavioral problems. Mm-hmm. And the good news for me is my mom was an amazing advocate for me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I was like in whatever, first grade, oh, he keeps talking in class. You know, well, my mom's like, well, maybe he's bored. Why don't we do the IQ test and see what's up? And it's like, oh, yeah, he's just bored. Mm-hmm. Right. So let's give him more demanding work. Right. Or, you know, when I'm, you know, thinking about, I was in high school and I went to a Catholic high school. And you know, some of the rules were arbitrary and I would occasionally, mm-hmm. get in trouble. And at one point I did something and they're like, hey, we want to kick him out. And my mom, you know, said, hey, look, you know, he takes a bus for an hour and a half to go to this school. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not trying to get out of this school. Mm-hmm. Right. He's doing the work to go to this school. So maybe you need to rethink what's going on for him in these moments.
Yeah.
And you know, and we all need that. I mean, you know, thank God that happened for you eventually. Mm-hmm. And I'm open for all the solutions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, and that's why at the end of the day, you know, the best choice is let's do everything. Yeah. Because the spectrum of problems is immense, right? Mm-hmm. There are people with serious mental illness. There are people, mm-hmm. let's say your family was a little chaotic but not problematic, but there's tons of people, their family is problematic. Mm-hmm. Right? There's sexual abuse, there's physical, mm-hmm. abuse, there's emotional abuse. There are these things going on that damage people and make it difficult for them to function in society. Mm-hmm. And because we haven't gotten to that point with mental health where it's what, you know what I mean? Like mental health services are available on demand. So people begin to self-medicate, right? And then you end up either psychologically addicted or physically dependent, right? And those, as you know, those become really difficult spots to get out. So at the end of the day, my goal is, you know, I don't want people having to go to jail and, you know, kill someone and go to jail for 20 years to get better, because that's expensive and awful. And I don't think you want that either.
No.
And I think we just have to be open to the fact that there isn't a solution. So, yeah.
It has to be comprehensive. But that doesn't seem, and I'm not putting California's policies on you by any measure, but there has to be that type of an approach where it isn't excluding other things. I don't
I just think we disagree about that. Like, I don't, I think,
why would he veto that bill then?
Well, you're just talking about a single bill. I mean, you've got to look at the whole apparatus. I mean, you can't just, and that's what I'm talking about. You can't devolve to, well, he did this one thing I didn't like, and so nothing else happened.
Does California promote treatment?
Sure. 100%. I just told you, check out Cal Ames. You will be pleasantly surprised.
Okay.
And I'm heartened. I mean, I was in Long Beach. So I was going here and I didn't finish the thought. So basically the last 18 months, I've given 7 or 8 talks to treatment, people who provide treatment. That's how you found me, right? People who provide treatment in all over California, right? And one of the things that's great because of this new Cal Ames system is that we actually have ways to get people into treatment better than we ever had. But that just happened, right? So I think one of the things is we have to keep growing that, and it's not available evenly, right? So there's more treatment in some places than in others, or for the demand, right? For the for the amount of demand. So that's one piece. The other piece, and this is something maybe where we disagree, is that at the end of the day, not everyone is ready for treatment at a given moment. And so what I would step into that space and say, okay, let's figure out a pathway to get you into a better place. And the reason why I say better place is because we also know, and this is, you know, true, most people actually stop their substance use without going to treatment. About half people, half the people, whether it's alcohol, nicotine, heroin, they figure out how to stop without treatment. So, you know, we want to keep people around so they can either have that moment of this time the treatment worked, or that moment of, oh, I figured it out myself, I'm good. And that's where harm reduction fits in. So you don't want to have a system where that doesn't exist. And you don't want to conflate a short period of time when we finally built out that system, right? Which, you know, I mean, when I was doing needle exchange in Oakland in 91, I got arrested for doing it, right? That's how far away we were from wanting to keep people alive, is we were arresting graduate students at UC Berkeley for, you know, using an effective public health intervention on people at risk for HIV. So we got a long ways to go to build out the harm reduction system. But I think those things happen in tandem with also now finally having a more robust treatment system. But always recognizing, you and I probably both wish, you know, folks were ready to stop when we want them to stop. That's not the world we live in. And so we want to keep people alive until they're ready.
So let me ask you a question. Everything, you know, no matter how well-intentioned, whether it's harm reduction, treatment, whatever it is, has positives and negatives, right? I mean, everything does. Nothing is just like, it's all good. So what, in your experience, because you're in this, what are the downsides of harm reduction?
I mean, I think the issue, I guess the question, here's the way I would ask the question. Are there unintended consequences?
Sure, yeah.
And I agree everything has unintended consequences. You know, I'm not, we've looked at some of these questions for harm reduction, and the major unintended consequences aren't obvious. So they're not problems. They don't come up. So one concern is, oh, if you're giving out needles, there'll be needle trash everywhere. And so there's probably a dozen studies now that have looked at that. And generally speaking, what happens is if you have a needle exchange program around, they're picking up needles, so there's actually less garbage, right? And then, excuse me, myself and colleagues, we did a study, you know, because we're sort of saying give people what they need. And what we found is, hey, when you give people enough syringes, they actually are more likely to return them. and not dispose of them inappropriately. There's a concern about crime. So there have been studies that have looked at geographies and spatial areas that have programs. It doesn't end up resulting in more crime. We've looked at people who use the program. Does their drug use increase, right? Which would be, I don't think that's a crazy thing to think, right? You're making it easier for them to use drugs, right? But it turns out it doesn't increase their drug use. And in fact, we have other studies that show that they're a great conduit into drug treatment. For some people, not everyone. You know, not everyone goes from syringe service to drug treatment, but people do. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I go back to the principles.
But what about... And
so if you want to change a behavior, give a person a resource to help them change that behavior. So we're getting better at making treatment available. That will help.
But what about this as an unintended consequence where you are making... You're making drug use, you're normalizing it, and you are, you know, you say stigma, which I don't necessarily think is a bad thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's stigma against being a child molester. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to be thought that. We probably would all agree that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. So there are things in society and behaviors that are just not good, and so... That's one of the things that I see as an unintended consequence is that it almost, you know, it's almost normalizing something that I don't think we should be normalizing it.
Well, I mean, I'm a scientist. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the question I would always become, what's the empirical data to support the idea that it's normal?
Look at the streets.
Well, hold on, no. Normalizing drug use. I don't think harm reduction is normalizing drug use. Mm-hmm. I would flip the script. Mm-hmm. I mean, here's where I come at it. Mm-hmm. You know, again, you know, we have to live in the world as it is. Like, everyone wants to alter their mood and have the capacity to alter their mood. Mm-hmm. You know, some people do it with exercise. Mm-hmm. You can do it with food. I like scotch. Mm-hmm. Other people are into nicotine. Mm-hmm. Like that, you know, that's humans. Mm-hmm. That's humans in primitive societies. That's little children spinning around in a circle.
It's not apples to apples on those things.
Of course.
What it does to your life.
Of course. So... But the point is that's probably fundamental to who we are as a species.
Yeah.
And there are better ways to manage it. Mm-hmm. And so if stigma stopped people from using drugs, maybe it would be useful. Mm-hmm. I just don't see the evidence that it does. And I don't also see the evidence that helping them stay alive normalizes it, because I think that happens independent of whether it's illegal or not.
I'm not talking about that specific individual.
No. I'm talking society. No, I know. But I think it's an empirical question, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think there's good evidence to show that the fact that these programs exist mean that drug use is normalized because these programs exist.
So drug use is on the rise for sure.
Drug use happens in this society consistently at a level that's higher than most people. That certainly, I'm comfortable with. I'm sure that you're comfortable with. Harm reduction isn't why that's the case. Mm-hmm. So that's all I would say.
Yeah, I'm not trying to put it all on that, but you can't go into any major downtown city and not see there's a difference, you know, in what you're seeing. It's just more open. It's more out in your face.
I go to a lot of cities, so be careful. Mm-hmm.
San Diego, L.A., are the two main ones that I'm thinking of.
But hold on. But there's, it's specific, right? So, like, I was in the Bay Area forever, right? Because I was in graduate school forever. You know, my parents lived in the Tenderloin in San Francisco at one point when I was in graduate school. So I know that neighborhood well. Mm-hmm. That neighborhood has been that way for a long time, right? Same thing with Skid Row in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So I would invite you to contemplate, what are the other things going on? Mm-hmm. And that's really, and maybe that's the difference at the end of the day, is that I agree that drug use contributes to that, but there's a bunch of other stuff going on, right? Economic inequality, absence of below market housing. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about the impact of incarceration on someone's life. Mm-hmm. Like, you're unusual, right? I mean, it's great that you were able to overcome that. There are not a lot of Chads in the world, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So we don't look at, you know, I mean, there are people trying to make more chads, right? So there's like the Anti-Recidivist Coalition, and, you know, there's specific programs working with long time, you know, where people get, they come out and they're great. But those are the exceptions, not the rule. Mm-hmm. So I'm in favor of those kinds of things, right? Like, you know, so, but I think we need to look at more than just drugs. Mm-hmm. So if we could snap our fingers tomorrow mm-hmm. and say no one in Skid Row is using drugs anymore, there would still be a bunch of people sleeping outside mm-hmm. because there are other problems going on that sure. led to that outcome. So,
and I guess that's kind of my thought is, I started by saying permissive harm reduction policy, and you don't seem to like the word permissive there.
I just think it misses the, it's, if by permissive you mean keeping people alive, then yes, but that's not what you meant.
Permissive in the sense of you are, okay, so let me back up. So I did a little bit of research, and this whole, philosophy seems to have started in Europe, specifically, Amsterdam, the Netherlands is kind of in the late 70s. And I remember I was thinking about it, I was like going back and went, oh yeah, I remember when they were talking about they're handing out needles and doing all and drugs in Amsterdam. And I was thinking at that time, that seems crazy. But that seems to be where it kind of started. I don't know
why were they hanging. Why were they handing out needles? Do you know?
Well, I think there was infectious disease.
Right. They were trying to prevent a hepatitis B outbreak.
Sure. Yeah. So, I'm not saying the intentions weren't good, but it seems like that it started kind of there, it permeated, and now it's kind of over. I don't know what difference is between that, philosophy and the philosophy here in the U.S. or if they're, the same, but there's some.
I'd invite you to listen to what I shared.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Client directed, practical mm-hmm. resources for the behavior change that you want, non punitive and non judgmental. Mm-hmm. That keeps people alive mm-hmm. so that they might recover. Mm-hmm. I think when you, again, if you keep trying to reduce it mm-hmm. into, well, it's this or that, or I like this or I don't like, look, there are lots of things that happen to society I don't like. There are lots of things that happen to society I do like. Mm-hmm. The truth is, that's not, as a scientist, what mm-hmm. I'm interested in is what's moving the needle, mm-hmm. right? And so what I would contend to you is that the concern you have that somehow we're normalizing drug use, like that happened, right? Mm-hmm. That just happened. Right. So you can go to any college campus in the United States, you will see lots of drug use happening. Mm-hmm. Would I wish it were different? Sure. But that, I don't control that. But what I do know is that we want those people to stay alive. Mm-hmm. If you go to a vocational training program, there are people using drugs in that. Mm-hmm. That's not great. But at the end of the day, if they end up in a chronic substance use disorder situation, I want them alive so that they have an opportunity mm-hmm. to be Chad.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's the impulse. And so what I don't want you to do is to come away from this conversation forgetting that there are a bunch of people who've cried mm-hmm. because their friends have died for overdose because we didn't have harm reduction services available. Right, there are lots of people.
Well, it's not going to save people from. A lot of it is pills now.
Well,
it's not going to do anything for that.
Well, the naloxone does if you get it out to enough people. So, the point is we're coming from an authentic place of mm-hmm. wanting to preserve human life, mm-hmm. uphold human dignity, and create pathways for people to be better than they are in a better mm-hmm. situation than they are at the current moment. Mm-hmm. That's what harm reduction is. Mm-hmm. It's part of the solution, mm-hmm. right? But it isn't the only thing we need to do. Sure. And, one of the things I say, in my regular talk is, look, I've made big contributions in the harm reduction space, but I know it's not enough because mm-hmm. there's still people unhoused and there's mm-hmm. still people hungry and there's still people exposed to violence. Mm-hmm. There's so much more to do. And so I want us focused actually on what's the practical thing we can do to help human well-being. Mm-hmm. And we don't get there in our politics, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's just an attempt. It's just too easy mm-hmm. to say, oh, this person got a counterfeit pill. We need more jail time for fentanyl dealers, whoever the hell that is, right? Mm-hmm. Because, of course, you know, these kids, you know, who are getting these pills, who are they getting pills from? You know, they're getting pills from like their cousin or their friend down the street. Like it, there's not a, you know, there's not an entity of a guy running around, I'm a fentanyl drug dealer, right?
Well, actually, we've had guests on here that lost their children and they got them from a drug dealer on Snapchat. So the kids are able to go on Snapchat. Right. There's drug dealers on there that have certain emojis that they use to identify themselves as drug dealers. And we've had several where, you know, the drug dealer drove from another city, dropped off the pills. The young person thought it was like Percocet or something. It was laced with fentanyl, took a half a pill and it killed them. So it does happen. It's not just like from neighbors or cousins.
I mean, that's a lot of, you know, you get the retail spaces like in Skid Row. Like you're there, you're buying it from who knows whatever.
Sure.
Anyway, so what I would say at this point is, like, I don't suspect that that person on Snapchat is trying to kill that person. You know, part of the problem is you have this illicit drug supply. And we don't, who knows what's in it, right? So we're getting better intelligence on that now because there's sort of voluntary drug testing programs.
That has to be a part of the solution, is trying to stop the flow of it.
I mean, sure. What's been the record of that?
It hasn't been good up to now. I mean, even like a lot of times people like to point, well, the war on drugs in the 80s was failed. And yeah, I think it was in large part, but there wasn't as, I don't think there was as big of an emphasis on preventing the drugs from actually coming here.
That's not true. I mean, that's one of the ironies. If you read some of the books on drug policy, you know, what you'll see is that most of the money goes actually to the Department of Defense. And it's around interdiction. So we spend a ton on that. And then increasingly over time, we've spent more on local policing and task force and stuff like that. But no, we've been trying. I mean, look, the country is huge. We have, you know, thousands and thousands of miles of more or less open border on both the north and the south. It's all coast. You know, so I think...
Lots of entry points.
So, you know, I would like to see us have more of a caring infrastructure. So, you know, I would like to see the 12-year-old Chad having someone who cares about him sit down and let's begin talking this through. And let's look at what are the other ways you can spend your energy that's not going to end up with you either using more substances or getting arrested. And I mean, I think that, I mean, that's what, in, you know, I'm an upper middle class guy. When kids in my sphere have problems, that's what happens, right? People put their resources in. We make sure that they get all the treatment options possible. And usually it works. Unfortunately, not all of us are upper middle class. And so for kids who are in lower income environments, they end up in this criminal legal system that's just going to destroy them. And we know that because it does.
Well, I think from, we'll just go ahead and wrap it up because I know you got to get going, but I haven't done, you know, I admit I haven't done a ton of research.
I do it for a living.
I'm starting to do it. And I feel, just my initial response is that you are more of an outlier. I mean, maybe you're right in the middle of it, but I mean, the stuff that I'm reading does not seem as... a measured approach as you are explaining. And I'm grateful that you have that. And I hope more people adopt that, but it doesn't seem like that's.
So again, I mean, here's our moment, right? It's very easy to say, okay, there are different groups making arguments about something. And when that happens and you identify with a group, right, you're taking the best of our arguments, and then you take the worst of the people you disagree with, right? And so that's why we end up not finding common ground, right? Look, I couldn't be more at the center of harm reduction in North America, right? I started one of the original Syringe Service programs in the early 1990s. I'm a founding board member of the National Harm Reduction Coalition. I'm dead center in the middle of it. My colleagues and the friends I have and the people working that have built out this movement are coming from the space I just told you of deep caring for people who have substance use disorder and are trying to come up with strategies that keep them alive so that they can have a better life at some point. And it works. And we know it works from science. So, you know, it's sort of, so like if I inverted it, right? Like, I don't think putting people in jail is a great idea. Mm-hmm. That's my general worldview. I think there are lots mm-hmm. of other ways of helping people with problems, with, you know, with some exceptions. But I don't think police mean to be doing this in the way they're doing it, or I don't think they're bad people, mm-hmm. right? You know, I think they're in a system that has its own incentives, mm-hmm. and that system isn't particularly good for making sure 12-year-olds don't end up as 21-year-olds in jail. Mm-hmm. That's my observation. I embrace them wanting to change that, and I hope they make that choice. Mm-hmm. But I don't dismiss their arguments just because mm-hmm. I'm not on that team. And so that's what I would just encourage you to do, is to mm-hmm. not fall into that, oh, this person on the other side said something crazy, so they're all like that.
Oh, no, I don't.
And the truth is, you know, as you do your research, what you'll see is that there are lots of studies supporting the premises behind what I've shared. Mm-hmm. And if you go and look at the prohibition one and the evidence, mm-hmm. you will see that there's lots of evidence that this doesn't actually work. Mm-hmm. Now, there are lots of reasons to have police. And, you know, substance use disorder isn't the main one. Mm-hmm. They sort of have wandered into that space. Mm-hmm. And maybe it'd be good if we wandered them out of it, mm-hmm. right, and brought in other people. And, you know, the serious mental illness stuff is a great example. So there's a big movement now when mm-hmm. someone's having a severe mental illness crisis to not send police, which totally makes sense because mm-hmm. they're not prepared to deal with someone who has serious mental illness. That's not their job. Mm-hmm. Right, so let's bring in healthcare professionals and psychiatrists that, who do have that experience. And mm-hmm. so I think that's part of what happens a little bit with police is that they get pulled into things that aren't their lane, mm-hmm. And then they just do their thing because that's the thing they know how to do.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I appreciate the time that you gave us and the conversation, and I will certainly do more of my research and. Yeah. So thank you very much.
Yeah, big fun.
Yeah, thank you for coming in, Doctor.
My pleasure.
All right.
Thank you for being a part of this much-needed conversation as we expose the raw truths about addiction. Don't forget to like, follow, and most importantly, share. Remember, addiction is the dirty little secret that every family deals with, but nobody wants to talk about.